You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 56 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington. Do you want to fill in one of your slogans from last week?
Home of Taco Time Northwest.
There you go. This is the Cliff Averill edition of the Peltoncast, number 56. And fitting this week, because Cliff Averill, we found out, came in number 56 on the NFL top 100 list.
Really?
The first Seahawk on that list.
Do all players have to come in their number?
It gets very complicated, yes, when you get to the top. There's a lot of quarterbacks who are coming in.
Numerous kickers.
And then the kickers. Yeah, Cam Newton, I guess, would have to be number one every year, basically.
Well, congrats to Cliff Averill. I think we should get to what we're drinking this week, so we can cheers to Cliff Averill, but then also we have to pour one out.
Pour a couple out in this case. Yes, I picked this up at Fred Meyer, I think, last week, from the Iron Horse Brewery in Ellensburg, Washington. One of our, I don't know if I quite go so far as to say favorite, but it's, you know, a regular staple.
I'm not that big of a fan.
The Faster Northwest Ale. And I had to search very hard on the internet to find any information about this beer, but it is apparently an ESB with nice amber color, nutty and caramel flavors, medium hop bitterness. So there you go. Iron Horse, of course, known for their Irish Death.
Well, should we cheers first to Cliff Averill?
Yeah.
But then also pouring one out to the Seahawks legend.
Very sad news earlier Tuesday as we learned that Cortez Kennedy had died in his Orlando home at the age of 48. Just way too young. Way too young. And the second loss of a Seattle legend from the 1990s of the past week.
Well, let's talk Cortez here for a little bit.
Okay.
I was wondering if we want to do a brief moment of silence for Cortez.
I don't know if that plays well on a podcast.
Okay. Thoughts, Cortez from the 90s. Do you have any memories?
I mean, I would say that Cortez Kennedy is one of the first Seahawks like I really knew about when I was starting to get into the team. Because I would say that 1992, the year that he won Defensive Player of the Year on a team that went 2-14.
It's unbelievable.
Incredible accomplishment. That was the first season that I was really aware of what was going on with the Seahawks, I'd say.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I have stronger memories of 93 the next year and of being very excited about Rick Meyer and optimistic about his future. But yeah, at that point, I mean, Cortez Kennedy was the Seahawks. You know, Steve Largent had retired. Dave Craig and Jim Zorn had moved on. Like, there were no classic Seahawks left at that point from the 80s teams that were not old enough to remember at all. So he was the guy.
It was his team. And he was what I would consider like the bridge legend. You've got the classic teams from the 80s, your Zorn Largent teams, Kurt Warner, people like that. And then after that, the team that went to the Super Bowl or kind of led to the team that went to the Super Bowl in the late 2000s, your Matt Hass, your Sean Alexanders. In the period between then, the 90s, there was Cortez Kennedy.
There was a revolving door of quarterbacks. There was Joey Galloway, who was quite an exciting player on offense, Sean Springs. But yeah, I mean, Tez was the guy. He was the Seahawks.
And it's kind of amazing to think about. I was thinking the 90s is kind of a peak era for defensive tackles being stars.
I suppose that's true.
But having your star player somehow winning Defensive Player of the Year on a 2-14 team be a defensive tackle?
But, I mean, you look at his production that season. It's undeniable. 92 tackles as a defensive tackle and 14 sacks, the most ever by an interior defensive lineman.
Unbelievable. I mean, having a defensive tackle with 14 sacks.
Yeah, it's just unthinkable.
I remember when we were kids, we thought that defensive tackles, maybe, I don't know if you did, but I thought defensive tackles were the people who got the most pressure.
I mean, I guess the other person we watched at that point would have been Steve Entman.
Yeah, Steve Entman, Cortez Kennedy, and then on that defensive line paired with Sam Adams.
Yeah. And then later when he left, the Seahawks brought in John Randall, who wasn't at the prime of his, you know, career that he spent with the Vikings, but same sort of thing where you got that interior pass rush.
So I don't know if I have... I mean, his peak years, I was very young in his peak years, right?
Yes.
And also, he was a defensive tackle. So I don't know if I have any specific memories of, like, the Cortez Kennedy play, but at the same time, you always knew, just undeniably, kind of like Walt Jones.
Yep.
It was like, this person is a Seahawks legend. He is clearly, when he was on the team, the best player on the team. And also, soft-spoken, and seemed like a person who everybody loved.
The other thing that would stand out on the field is reliability. Never missed a game in his 11 seasons.
Insane!
That's hard to imagine.
He never missed a game?
Yeah. But yes, I think one thing that's become very clear, and you know, maybe it's unfortunate always that it takes a moment like this, although we did have his induction into the Hall of Fame in 2012.
I think we knew all along, though, that Tez was awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's harder to know like during his playing career because there wasn't social media back then. There weren't the kind of avenues to find out that about players' personalities necessarily. But since then, yes.
So I would say shocking news.
For sure. I mean, it definitely was not something you were ever expecting to hear.
And then also, we had to pour another one out for another Seattle legend in Soundgarden Audioslave lead singer Chris Cornell.
Yeah, I mean, this... I feel like it was a much bigger deal for the Seattle music community than it was for probably either of us personally. Despite your being in the Seattle music community.
Periphery at best. So, Chris Cornell's a weird one, right? I guess first, before we talk about what he meant... it's interesting to think about the lasting legacy of these grunge lead singers and to look at it and see first Kurt Cobain, then Layne Staley, Scott Weiland from Stone Temple Pilots, and now Chris Cornell, and understand just how serious of a problem drugs were for people involved with this genre, and also how much they meant it with the music. You know, it's very bleak music. Listening to Soundgarden now, it's not like you listen to it and you're like, yeah, okay. They didn't at the time necessarily seem like as bleak of a band as some of their peers, but definitely was. I mean, there's Black Hole Sun, which you can understand in a lot of different ways. Like hearing Black Hole Sun come and wash away the rain, being from Seattle, you get it that way. But then also understanding that in terms of Chris Cornell having drug problems too. It's been an interesting thing to look back on that genre and how its legacy has played out.
I mean, two of the five singles from their breakthrough album do have black in the title. Fell on Black Days being the other one of it.
Yes.
So,
and the Fell on Black Days.
Okay, here's my question about Chris Cornell for you. How much do you think his legacy was shaped by that entire era? Like, obviously, it elevated Soundgarden and Chris Cornell, but also kind of puts him in this group as opposed to him standing out individually.
I think that's definitely true, where you look at all these different people who are involved, and if you focus on kind of the Seattle people, it was like Kurt Cobain and Nirvana were this band who were kind of otherworldly, right? Like, growing up, we knew that they were on a different echelon than everybody else.
Right.
It was like, if you look at the 90s, there are maybe three pillars of 90s music, maybe a couple more, but it's like Kurt Cobain, Biggie, Tupac, people like that, right?
You just left out Dr. Dre.
Dr. Dre, okay, he's not dead. So he doesn't get the same kind of pinnacle.
Okay, that's what you were saying.
But no, there's Dr. Dre, even like Madonna in the 90s. They were huge artists then, but Kurt Cobain's there, and Chris Cornell's not at that level.
Yes.
Right? And then you have Pearl Jam, who've developed over time this cult following. Where Pearl Jam in some ways are kind of like the new jam band. People go and see them as much as they can.
Yep.
They have every single live show that they play is an event. They do these shows. They can play at Wrigley Field. And they're the band that has had kind of the longest lasting legacy of this.
Yeah.
Maybe noting that their lead singer is not from Seattle originally. Chris Cornell, I would say, is kind of in that lump of other singers, right? Which is interesting because as a singer, he's somebody when you see him, and I saw him live one time with Audioslave in like the early 2000s. But the thing that you really noticed about him at that time, I mean, you could tell from his music, but his voice is so much better than everybody else in the scene,
mm-hmm.
right? Like Chris Cornell as a voice stood out so much when seeing him live.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one thing where I saw somebody say that he would have been a rock star in any era. And I think that that's something which is probably true, and I could see some of the other people in that scene not being rock stars.
Being a product of their times.
Yes. But the other thing is, when I think about Chris Cornell, I think that both you and I are a little bit too young for it to have had the same kind of impact as it might have had we been 5 to 10 years older.
I mean, it feels weird for me to say that because, like, I have a friend who is, you know, a couple months younger than I am, who's like a huge fan.
And I'm not saying that people aren't huge fans. I'm sure there are plenty of people that are the exact same age that are big fans of Soundgarden and Chris Cornell. But for me, and I think also you personally, they didn't feel like our band.
No. Right?
So like the first time that I had ever heard a Soundgarden song was probably the video for Black Hole Sun, watching it on MTV.
That seems likely. I mean, definitely that summer, it feels like, was like dominated by a
93 or 92.
No, it was later than that. I think that was 94.
The summer of 94. Yeah, I mean, and I wouldn't have even known necessarily that they were from Seattle. They didn't feel like our band. It was kind of like they'd kind of become... Nirvana did a little bit more because Kurt Cobain died in Seattle, and it was a little bit more of a Seattle experience, but Soundgarden felt like something bigger. You know, it's like I'd seen them on MTV for the first time, right? I wasn't seeing them play after a Mariners game, like somebody like the Presidents, right? We didn't see them have this unbelievable, shocking breakthrough single like Harvey Danger, right? Okay. Like, those are bands that we knew personally.
Because of the fact that you saw them go through the process of getting to the national standpoint as opposed to just meeting them as a national band?
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, I'm not saying that, like, I knew Harvey Danger as an underground artist. It was, like, 1996 or something, but... maybe a little bit later. But we knew at the time, we were old enough to know at the time, that they were our band. And for Soundgarden, it never really felt like that. And the only way that we would have seen them as a local band during that time period is like, you know, the Lame List.
Yes.
Right? Yes, That's one of the lasting legacies of Soundgarden for us as kids.
Yep.
So I think that they were on a different pedestal. You know, they felt like the general public's band. They didn't feel like our band. And so there are people who came after that. Like I mentioned, like the Presidents, Harvey Danger. And then also, as you get a little bit later, looking at artists like, you know, the Microphones, Mount Airy, Phil Elverum. And then people like the indie rock movement.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those bands all of a sudden were like, these are bands that represent the Northwest that we know a little bit more so than this grunge Northwest. And it's like Death Cab for Cutie in the early 2000s, Modest Mouse in the early 2000s, and all the way through to somebody like Fleet Foxes, where I have these stories. With Soundgarden, I don't have any stories, right? I don't, right. You know, I seen Chris Cornell that one time. I remember seeing them on TV. That's really it, you know, hearing them being played on the end. But I don't have any personal stories. But then seeing a band like Fleet Foxes come out, when it was a little bit more age appropriate, and I have all the stories you're supposed to have, like seeing them in a small club or whatever, like, oh, I saw one of their early shows reviewed it for a website that I was working at and highly panned Fleet Foxes.
Did you?
Do you remember this?
Wait, was this for the Seattle Times or was this
not with the small website I was working for, the Seattle Times?
I didn't know how to scan that. Where was the website?
It was mercurialsound.com.
No, I don't remember. I don't remember that at all.
I wrote a piece on them, like a Michael Bennett type piece in the Seattle Times about Foxes.
Oh, no.
Like, not enough charitable giving. You know, they're just too immature of a band.
No.
But no, they're a band that...
Fortunately, Robin Pecknold did not hold it against you.
I sent an email. This is the crazy thing. So I wrote this review, and I think this was like, it was very early on. I just started writing about music. And I think I called, they were opening for an artist named Matt Costa at the Crocodile. And I was like, Fleet Foxes like are not that put together of a band, but they look really good or something. And then I sent it to Robin Pecknold, which, what was I thinking? Why did I do that?
I mean, you did say they looked really good.
and he responded and was like, that's a very nice looking site you have there.
That's good.
I'm just like, what was I thinking? But those are the types of stories. And then also, like, got to know Robin Pecknold personally after that and saw them go from a band that was playing. You know, I was booking them at Capitol Block Party to all of a sudden they're, like, playing on the Sasquatch main stage. So it's kind of, they're a band that's a little bit more age appropriate for me than somebody like Soundgarden. And we were able to see this last weekend. You mentioned that you'd never been to a music show at the Showbox.
I did.
And so you went to your first on Friday, and that was those very Fleet Foxes coming back after a long hiatus.
When you say those very Fleet Foxes, it makes them sound fast.
very Fleet Foxes.
Yes, incredibly Fleet Foxes. No, it was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was a full circle moment, I think, for you, but then also for them to be playing in this relatively small venue in Seattle in advance of their world tour, which is kicking off next week in support of their upcoming new album.
And they're doing something like 4 or 5 sold out Sydney Opera Houses.
Yeah, and then just straight from Showbox to there.
They really literally were flying from the Showbox to the Sydney Opera House.
Well, no, they have to go to the airport first. You can't fly from the Showbox. It's much too small.
But it is crazy to think that they're playing like 1,100 tickets in Seattle, and then all of a sudden 4 nights at like one of the most legendary venues in the world.
Which obviously they could do more in Seattle and will in September when they play Paramount, Seattle's historic Paramount Theater, 2 nights in a row. But
the office is what we call it.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it was both fun and also vaguely terrifying in terms of the claustrophobia to see them in such a small.
Yeah, what do you think the percentage of dudes with beards was?
Oh, so high.
Like, is it over 100% somehow?
Well, no, because Robin Pecknold was clean shaven, wasn't he?
Oh, no beard for Robin Pecknold. Yeah. Oh, he was the one.
And then one of the guitarists was as well. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sky. I think Sky was.
Yeah.
I also sent my negative review to him.
Terrific.
It was a very bearded crowd.
It was. Yeah. They were feeling it.
But the one way that I was thinking about similarities for there, I'm thinking about Chris Cornell, and similarities between the two of them is standing out from everybody else is Robin Pecknold's voice.
It's angelic.
Seeing him open solo for Joanna Newsom at the Paramount last year, and I hadn't really thought about Robin Pecknold for a while, and he's opening the show. I'm like, okay, I'll go see this. And then all of a sudden he starts singing, and you're like, oh my God, Robin Pecknold.
You in some ways didn't realize how much you'd missed it until it came back.
Yes. And I think he's someone who, you know, I can't say that Robin Pecknold would have been, you know, a rock star in any era, because I don't know if I'd necessarily describe him as a rock star. But he has a voice that is so timeless. He could have fit in musically in any time period.
So I think in many ways, the strength and the weakness of the couple of new songs that they've released in advance, the singles they've released in advance of their new album, which comes out next month, is they sound very much in the pantheon of Fleet Foxes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I was driving to go meet you for lunch today, and now I can't remember the name of one of the two singles.
May 3rd.
Not the other one.
Oh, man, I can't remember what the other one's called.
All right, now I'm going to have to look it up. But that came on the radio, and I was like, I've heard this song 1,000 times. And it's not true. I've listened to it.
The word endless in it or something.
It is a fool's errand.
Fool's errand.
Fool's errand. And I had listened to it several times over the weekend after going to the show. But still, it's because of the fact that I've heard that song 1,000 times. And
yes.
It's, I mean that as a compliment. But it is interesting.
Yeah, you say that and I can hear it in my head with the Robin Pecknold voice.
Exactly.
Yes. So anyway, it was exciting that you got to go to your first ever music show at the Showbox and see a band like that come full circle. And I think, you know, like when we look back 20, 30 years from now in this era, those are the artists who we're going to have these stories about. I feel like I'm saying that as if we're talking about Robin Pecknold dying. But when we look back on artists from that era, I think drug problems are not quite as prevalent with the genre of music. But when we look back on this time period, we're going to have so many personal stories just because it's 10, 15 years later.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. So I guess we're telling people to wait for that.
Yeah. I was wondering at some point, maybe if it seems relevant, if we should do like a top 5 Northwest indie rock songs.
That could be interesting. Okay. Anything else on Chris Cornell?
Just a weird week.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we're not having to devote this long segment to people passing away in the future. But, yeah, definitely.
And instead, let's devote more time to burgers.
Okay. That was, wow, what a segue. So the place we went for lunch today was the 206 Burger Company, which has two locations, one of them in the Marion Food Court downtown, which when I looked it up, I realized I had once gone there many, many years ago when
what
I worked at the Sonic's
Marion
office.
What is the Marion Food Court?
It's like a block area where they've got restaurants ringing the edge, and then in the middle, they've got tables for you to eat. It's basically like a food truck roundup, except it's actual brick-and-mortar restaurants.
I don't think I've ever been there.
Trucks. I only went there once.
This seems like something I'm into because I love food courts.
I know.
And food trucks.
I mean, I thought about suggesting we go there because it was a gorgeous day to eat outside, but they have a fuller menu at the other location,
which is
at 10th and Madison.
They probably had the burger that we ordered.
They did have the burger.
If they didn't have the 206 burger at that location, it'd be a problem.
Yeah, so we forwent, is that the right word there? Uh-huh. Passed over? They have burgers named after the Sonics, Sounders, Seahawks, and Mariners. You probably wouldn't want to order the Mariners burger right now.
Yeah,
probably
you'd probably choke on it.
Yeah. But we passed on those in favor of the eponymous 206 burger.
We're covering all of them by having the 206 burger.
What did you think? Oh,
okay. So this was a burger place that neither of us had been to before, right?
Oh, yeah. Hadn't even really heard of it until you brought it up as a location.
I would say
it's
pretty well reviewed on the internet, right?
Yeah, very much so. I take it you're not a fan.
It was totally fine.
Okay.
But I found the burger and the fries to just be kind of bland. I wasn't getting a lot of flavor there, right? It's like when you have a Red Mill burger, it's exploding with flavor in your mouth. So the 206 burger has your normal burger patty. There's some sort of house sauce, onions, tomato, avocado, and bacon.
Yep. And pickles.
When I look back on it, none of those flavors stood out to me. The bun is a very solid bun, but also doesn't have a lot of flavor.
I thought it was the best bun we had. So both, I believe both they and Unita use Macrina buns, but theirs is toasted slightly better. It was the perfect level of toasting, number one bun in my book.
The bun was very good. But
so I felt much more positive about the entire experience.
The flavor to me, what I'm looking for is I want melted cheese, like really good melted cheese.
Yeah, the cheese was kind of just meh.
Mixed with some sort of secret type sauce, right? House sauce, something like that. I just want that flavor exploding in every bite. And to me, this was just like, it was bland.
I thought the avocado added a nice flavor.
Did you?
I'm maybe more pro avocado than you are.
I mean, I'm pro avocado.
It's our loyal listener, Chris, will note.
You need avocado to... Well, you are Alvocado.
Yeah, exactly.
Follow at Alvocado on Twitter.
No. Do not follow that.
You need more flavor to mix with the avocado.
I mean, what I would do, I think, if I went back, if I ordered the same burger, was ask for like a cup or something of secret sauce to add some more.
Yes.
And it sounds like you were interested in doing the same.
Yes.
Because that was my only
I'm interested
real complaint.
In doing the same everywhere.
Yeah, like, clearly. We know how you feel about secret sauce. You love you some secret
but
sauce.
If you go to Zippy's, they have a big squirt bottle full of sauce. If we had that here, look, my whole feelings about the burger may be different.
The other very minor pet peeve I had about this,
okay,
which I told you I couldn't discuss while we were eating lunch.
Because we actually, when we go to these burger places, sit in complete silence.
We do not sit in complete silence. We talk about Chuck Klosterman. Is that they have like the veggies and the avocado below the burger patty.
Yep.
And I get why they do that because of the fact that it allowed the cheese to like melt to the bacon and then the top bun.
I'm not necessarily against it.
I am like a strict, you know how strict my rules are on these sorts of things. Uh-huh. You got to have the veggies above the patty.
I'm trying to think. I think there was a burger that I really liked where the burger was on the top and the veggies were on the bottom.
I don't know what that was.
It couldn't have been true.
No, I'm not saying it couldn't be true.
But you know how sometimes...
Just a minor pet peeve.
It's the cheese to me that I think really was the issue here.
Huh.
It was the cheese and secret sauce ratio. So you know sometimes with cheddar cheese, it can get kind of just kind of dry or like hard. You can see like a thick piece poking out the side of just like a string of cheese.
Again, you're describing any time our mom made burgers.
That's what it. I felt like I could have made this burger myself. And I don't go to Red Mill and think to myself, I can make that burger. There's no way I can make a Red Mill burger.
But you couldn't make the bun.
I also thought I could buy the bun at Macarena. It wouldn't be that hard.
I also thought the...
Oh, I can do it tomorrow.
I also thought the lettuce, for whatever reason, it was like very nicely chopped and it was a good bed of lettuce.
Really? Yeah. Good bed of lettuce.
I was much more positive on this entire experience than you were. In fact, there were times where I considered rating this like in the top three burgers we've had.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. I ended up walking it down because of the fact that also it's
because of the goddamn veggies below the burger.
Yeah, no, mostly because of the lack of secret sauce. The patty is kind of modest, I would say. It's not enormous.
It's just not doing anything for you. It's a patty. I don't need the patty to be the star of the show.
You don't, no.
But I need something to be the star of the show.
But I still rated this a 90.
Wow. Yeah. I gave it an 85.
Interesting. We have a disagreement again. I think people like this. When we take sides.
When we take sides. It's like the San Antonio Spurs without Kawhi Leonard.
That seems unnecessarily harsh.
Look, they played totally fine in a lot of those
games.
There's
no one as good as the bun on the San Antonio Spurs without Kawhi Leonard. Unless you're saying Pop is the bun.
Pop's the bun. Look, Pop's, and that's actually the perfect analogy.
It actually is.
You have the best bun, and you've got a lot of role players, but you've got no star, right?
I suppose.
And for the record, I don't just need secret sauce. It doesn't have to be that. I need some kind of sauce. Honestly, if a ketchup mustard pairing would have really stood out here, that would have been nice. But something, an aioli, some kind of sauce.
It's interesting because, so I went to Loretta's on Monday. This is going to be day two of day three consecutive days with burgers, but I think we've actually changed that plan now, sadly. And the ketchup mixed with, because they didn't have quite enough secret sauce, but then you mix in the ketchup on there and you've got enough sauce and it's a nice flavor combination.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
I went to Dick's for the first time in probably a year this weekend.
I think you would have said that. I went to the Dick's for the first time. Never been there before.
It made me wonder why we're even doing the search. But
can I reiterate my terrific pun I made to you while you were on the phone asking me for directions?
What was that?
You were trying to walk to a bank to get cash for Dick's, and I informed you that they now take cards, and then was able to tell you, go back the other way, we'll stop and eat at Dick's.
You were so proud.
So proud.
So proud that you're repeating it here. Oh, you almost tweeted it.
That's one of my best lines.
It was excellent. It's one of Sir Mix-a-Lot's best lines, too.
I agree.
Being at Dick's, I somehow spent like $23 at Dick's.
Did you? How?
I got four Dick's Deluxes. Because in the past, you know,
got four Dick's Deluxes?
No. You think I'm trying to exceed Ben B's two in and out double doubles?
Shout out to Loyalist like, there, Ben
B's. It's like I had eight burger patties. Bring it. No, I gave two of them to Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
Okay.
They were not all for myself.
Bring them home.
But my previous Dick's order used to be a deluxe, a special, and a cheeseburger and fries. And I decided, I really just like the deluxe. Why don't I get two of those? I'm an adult.
I mean, I do like sometimes the slightly contrasting flavor of the cheeseburger or the special. Oh, wait, the special doesn't have contrasting flavor, does it?
The special is basically the same as the deluxe with one less patty and no cheese.
Yeah, okay. So I like the cheeseburger because of the fact that the ketchup and mustard on there offers a contrasting flavor to the deluxe.
Yeah, or no, the special. I'm not against. I considered doing two deluxes and a cheeseburger, but I also got a peppermint and hot fudge sundae, and I sat and ate it in my car like an animal.
Quite a Saturday afternoon.
This is like an 80 degree day. It was perfect.
Have you decided what we're going to go get next week?
No.
Okay. I guess we'll tweet it out if you come up with a decision at some point here.
I can maybe look for something. Well, you're going to be gone in Kansas City, right? So we have to go somewhere soon.
Well, I think we will likely plan to go there again next Tuesday.
Okay. So we were initially going to go to Linda's for my birthday, but we've canceled that plan.
We have.
And are now going to go to Linda's on the week of June 9th.
June 8th is the date we're going there, I believe.
We're going to Linda's on June 8th.
Yes.
For the Vera Project's A Drink for the Kids event.
Which is now titled A Drink for Vera. If you would like to join us at that, I suppose I suppose you could.
It'd be for a good cause.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the kids.
Yeah, for kids. Should we talk about sports? Let's go to the NBA playoffs.
All right.
Which no longer include any University of Washington point guards. It's really amazing how quickly
you know, the Celtics are still alive.
Yeah, but he's not healthy.
Okay.
Isaiah Thomas is injured. He is out for the year with an injury to his hip labrum that apparently he suffered in March when he missed some time.
Really?
Re-aggravated, I believe, during Game 6 of the series against the Wizards. Played through it and had that great Game 7, but then just couldn't do it in Game 2 against Cleveland. Either of the two games against Cleveland. Left Game 2 at halftime and then saw a specialist on Tuesday. Still unclear whether he will need surgery for that injury. But I think it's about a 3-month timetable if he does undergo surgery. Dang. Should be back in plenty of time for training camp either way.
To lose his job to Markelle Fultz.
I don't think so.
Okay, so what do we make of the fact that the Celtics have played significantly better since Isaiah Thomas has been injured in this Cavs series?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what happened, it was weird. LeBron attributed it after the game today to them needing to adjust their game plan because they had game planned around the Celtics with Isaiah Thomas. I would attribute it mostly to them not taking the Celtics very seriously after beating them badly in the two games in Boston, and then Thomas going out of the lineup and taking an 18-point lead, I think, in the first half of Game 3.
I love that the Cavs are phoning in Eastern Conference championship games. Like, it's insane when you get to that level. Wait, how many championships?
Your question to me earlier was like, so when are they going to play hard? Are they going to play hard in the next series? I'm pretty sure they will.
How many finals in a row has LeBron been to?
He's been to 6.
So this would be his 7th.
I'm sorry. Yes. Yes, that is correct.
If he goes this year, it'd be
also,
his 7th.
It would also be James Jones' 7th.
Okay. I think James Jones is trying as hard. He's phoning it in too.
He's not. Yeah. He's not.
If you're LeBron and you've gone to 7 straight finals, you only have to start trying when you get to the finals.
I just think they were so dominant in the first couple of games that there was a false sense of security, especially after they had that big lead early in Game 3. And they were not expecting that Marcus Smart was going to come out and make 7 3-pointers.
So you're saying there's nothing to this?
There's not much to it. I mean, the Celtics, their ball movement has been really good. They've been able to take advantage of Cleveland's defensive lapses doing that. But when the Cavs got serious in the second half, we saw them struggle to score, which is how they've what has happened over the course of the year when Isaiah Thomas hasn't been available for them. And then Kyrie Irving scored 46 points. So that was the thing that happened, including 21 points on 105 true shooting percentage.
Really?
In the third quarter.
Oh my God.
It was 9 of 10 for the field, made 2 threes and a free throw on an and-one.
So you can get to over 100% true shooting percentage, just like you can get to over 100% beards at the Fleet Foxes show?
Yes, yes, that is an apt comparison. So the other UW point guard who is no longer in the playoffs is DeJounte Murray of the Spurs, who were eliminated in a sweep by the Golden State Warriors. Still a good series, all things considered, for DeJounte.
Did he? Husky point guards feel like they kind of fizzled this year.
You know, a week ago was probably the high point for them.
Like, they're only used to getting to the NIT.
Well, Isaiah Thomas wasn't.
Sometimes the CBI.
Isaiah Thomas was used to getting to the NCAA tournament. Anything else on the NBA playoffs while we're
so
here?
Let's assume that the Cavs win Game 5, right?
Okay.
Feels like a pretty comfortable assumption.
It's more likely than not.
NBA Finals feels like a sweep to me.
That's crazy. That's disrespectful to LeBron.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you if you had to pick it right now, how many games?
I'm torn between 5, 6, or 7. I mean, picking the series to end in a road game is not always a wise move. So if the Cavs can get it to 6, then they probably can get it to 7. I think, I guess if I had to pick one, I would probably go 5 at this point. But I don't think that it's going to be a sweep.
You know the Warriors aren't trying their hardest either.
I don't think their effort level is as variable as the Cavaliers is. Which is why they didn't have a long stretch of the season where they were one of the three worst defenses in the NBA. They never had a stretch where they didn't lose the number one seed to Boston.
They're just that good.
They are that good. And
they're the Warriors, and they added Kevin Durant. I feel like people somehow keep forgetting this.
Yeah. No, I agree. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to sweep the Cavs. I mean, they lost to Cleveland in the regular season, remember?
Who are you cheering for in the series?
In the finals?
Yeah. I just don't know who to want to win.
I mean, I'm cheering for whoever I pick, A.
Yes.
And B, whatever creates the least takes.
Okay. That's
the main thing. So like a sweep actually would probably be a bad thing. That would probably create a lot of takes.
Because that would create takes both about the Warriors and about LeBron?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
A nice six-game series probably creates the fewest possible takes.
Okay.
So, we'll see on that one. On the arena front, it was relatively quiet until an interesting story from Cairo Radio this past week, citing sources close to the mayor and indicating that the staff is leaning, this is Mike Lewis of Cairo Radio who had this on their website, that Ed Murray's staff is expected to recommend the proposal from the Oakview Group to Ed Murray, which not terribly surprising. I think, you know, I think I've said in the past it was something like a 70-30 favorite
okay.
over the Seattle Partners proposal, in as much as it does not require the upfront public financing. Some of the other aspects of the article perhaps more interesting and surprising. Let's see. Besides the lack of financing, they also noted that a reason to favor it was the rumored inside track to an NHL franchise, which does not make sense to me, in as much as the Seattle Partners Group has a potential NHL owner, Victor Coleman, who's been interested in owning an NHL team, is part of that group.
Okay.
And here's the other thing, and I want to make this very clear to people. Getting an NHL franchise, if there is an interested owner, is not going to be an issue. The NHL will welcome Seattle with open arms whenever there is an arena and an owner. Those are the only two things they need. It does not matter which arena. It does not matter. I mean, it does matter to some extent which owner. It has to be someone who has the money and is a credible NHL owner. But look, the NHL is coming to Seattle
wow.
as soon as it can.
I like that. Definitive, the NHL is coming to Seattle.
Like, that is not a reason to pick one of these proposals over another
if
one.
If you take any takeaway from this podcast, I want that to be it.
Yeah. The TLDR of this podcast is the NHL is coming to Seattle
wow.
as soon as it can.
And they the NHL Seattle. Is outside of Seattle's window with a boombox.
They really are. It's funny. They get they got rejected last time. Had to expand only to Vegas.
Okay, so the NHL is coming to Seattle.
Okay, so the other thing from this story, the last section of it is entitled Wither Chris Hansen in Soto. And the line here, Hansen's proposal by many accounts in City Hall appears nearly dead.
Really?
Which I think would be news to the city council members who are voting on this proposal.
In City Hall being...
In this case, clearly based on the content of the story, this is sources close to the mayor who are trying to push the mayor's agenda.
And the mayor's agenda is to choose one of these two proposals?
He has made it...
Because this choice, before we get anywhere, before you answer that question, this choice that you're talking about, this Oakview choice, is just between the two key arena proposals. It has nothing to do with Chris Hansen, right?
That is correct.
Chris Hansen is solely relying on the city council at this point for the street vacation.
Which both of these rely on the city council, because the mayor will just choose one of these. He still has to submit it to the city council to actually, you know, be committed into a binding contract.
Yes.
So it's all in the council's hands. The mayor actually doesn't really have that much power, especially in as much as he's a lame duck. And like to be going around talking about the proposal is nearly dead when one of the leading candidates for mayor, Mike McGinn, the previous mayor, this all gets very confusing at some point. The former mayor and future mayor.
Mike former McGinn, and future mayor.
Is on the record is saying he favors voting for the street vacation and then subsequently figuring out between Kiarita and the Soto location. So how much power Ed Murray actually wields in this is largely unclear to me.
Okay. And so the way that they're wielding their power or trying to is by leaking something that...
Yes. Spinning the process.
Where does city council... How do they relate to this? Like, if he says that the Chris Hansen proposal is nearly dead in City Hall, where is City Council at? Are they in City Hall?
They are in City Hall, yes.
Like, is he talking about them, or what is he talking about when he says that?
I mean, it's not, first off, it's not any That's, to quote this directly, by many accounts in City Hall.
By many accounts. Many people are saying.
Yes. I mean, that's the implication. But again, I think that's people speaking for city council members who probably don't want to get spoken for that way.
Yes.
And may resent the attempt.
Honestly, this is probably a good thing. Because the last time that the city council vote happened, we took it as almost a foregone conclusion that it would be a yes vote. And then it was a shocking no vote.
The other interesting part of this is at the end, speculates that there's a council of, let's see here, Seattle's Industrial Lands Advisory Panel, which is a 27-member panel, and has the ability to convert some of the area that's currently zoned industrial into commercial use or residential use.
Okay.
Including the land that Hansen's group has bought in the Soto area around where the arena would be, and including where the arena would be. And they speculate that, let's see here, noted one person close to the process who asked to remain anonymous, doing so, that might keep him happy and quiet so the city can focus on Seattle Center. And I would say that quote really drives home to me how little they understand what Chris Hansen is doing. Look, obviously they want to make money on this surrounding area by developing that, but that's a part of the plan to make it successful to bring the NBA and the NHL to Seattle.
Yeah, he's wearing a Sonics jacket, not a commercial and residential jacket.
Right. I mean, Chris Hansen's passion for the Sonics and for Seattle sports is a driving force for this project, as we discussed on last week's episode. Yeah.
And that is such a strange quote. Keep him happy and quiet?
Yeah.
It feels pretty condescending.
It is. Yeah. No, very much so.
I guess I'm impressed with Chris Hansen's resilience here.
So, we'll see how that plays out.
But no,
that
was none of this very is interesting. Really news yet. The thing that's the most news here is you saying that the NHL is coming to... No. Is that Ed Murray prefers the Oakview Group.
Yes. That is the specific new information here, yeah.
And if they've gone to the level of probably leaking it to the press...
And he said that he wants to have this announcement well before the end of June. So, you know, I think they're along that process, well along that process.
Okay. But before we get to anything else, I think a congrats is in order.
Is it?
Yeah, for UW softball.
Yes. UW softball beat Michigan in the regional last weekend and now will host Utah in the super regional starting Friday night at 8 p.m. It's a best of three series. The winner... to the College World Series. I can't remember exactly what they call the World Series. But so there you go.
But I think also a sad grats is in order.
Yes. Following back up on last week's news about the Seattle Thunderbirds, they went to the Memorial Cup and went 0-3 and were beaten in by a combined score of 17-3. So it turns out that the Canadian Major Junior Hockey League is much better than the WHL.
We should have taken them much more seriously. That team from Red Deer.
So a little bit of a disappointing end to their season, but still a hearty congrats on the first WHL championship.
Oh, it's huge. Huge. Yeah. We'll be remembering that for years.
All right. I think it's time for a very special segment that you've come to know and love. Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
It's almost hard to have hot takes this time. Because my real hot take is that there are no hot takes. This team is irrelevant. We have reached the point that...
You needed to emphasize that more.
Irrelevant.
Yes.
This team has come early to the point that we're used to getting to in July and August, and they do not matter. But most importantly, there is a hot take, and that hot take is we have got to start asking ourselves a question.
Okay.
Is this team partying too hard on the weekends?
Oh, wow.
You know me. I'm a stats guy. I looked it up. 2 weekends ago, they lost 4 in a row to the Blue Jays, to the lowly Blue Jays.
That checks out.
This last weekend, play fine during the week. They're playing fine during the week a lot, if you haven't noticed. And then they come into the weekend, and they lose 3 in a row to the Chicago Cubs. I've seen this happen. Also, I've heard Jalen Rose speak before.
Also to the White Sox.
To them too.
Rough week. Rough weekend.
They lost all six of the games. I've heard Jalen Rose speak before about what happens on the road. And I know this team. This team is partying too hard. They are out there. And on the weekends, do you know who their best pitcher is?
I don't
know. First baseman Mike Freeman.
Okay. You pitched the mop-up inning.
The Mariners coming up. I can't even name their starters. Have you seen this? I'm thinking they need to get Freeman into the rotation.
That's a hot take. That qualifies.
You look at their relief pitching war. They've got one, maybe two players who are worth even 0.1 win. And Mike Freeman is one of those players.
What?
No, I don't think he actually
is. Oh, okay.
I think he's still at zero.
Oh, that's too bad.
They've got no relief. They've got no starting pitching. Thank the Lord for John Segura. Without John Segura, there would be nothing else. And I want to take that at least Taiwan Walker isn't doing well. But everybody wins. Everybody plays in that trade. Because Taiwan Walker is playing well. John Segura is playing well. Mitch Haniger is playing well. Everybody involved with that trade is the best player on their team. Everybody previously on the Mariners is terrible.
So one problem with your theory about the weekend is that the Mariners opened a series in Washington on Tuesday night and lost 10-1. Who is this pitcher who started for them? His name is Bergman? I've never heard of this person.
I mean, we could look at the rotation. You can look at the rotation coming up and you're not going to have heard of any of them. You might have heard of Giovanni Gallardo at this point. The Red Sox, who they play this weekend, who they will get swept by this weekend,
okay,
do not have a starter named for Friday, and I would rather see him out there than see Giovanni Gallardo.
You'd rather see D. N-A? TBD. TBD. So the Mariners now have lost their last three games by a combined score of 34-3. They are 3-9 in their last 12 games, and their playoff odds are down to 8.7%, which honestly is higher than I was expecting.
A shocking 8.7%.
Yeah. Anything else to say here? You're just shaking your head. That's, again, not great podcast material.
We should have known this was coming.
Some of us did, if you go back to the bold predictions before.
Did I make positive bold predictions?
I'm pretty sure you did.
What was I thinking?
You didn't understand the Mariners' every other year curse.
They come near making the playoffs, and then they're bad.
it's an inescapable.
It would be one thing if they actually made the playoffs and right, then every other right, year.
Exactly. That,
it'd be
that
pretty impressive if they were making the playoffs.
The Milwaukee Bucks do that.
The Milwaukee Bucks do this too?
Yeah, like every one year they'll make the playoffs, and then the next year they'll be terrible. So we'll see next year if that holds again.
Oh, and the Mariners have Mitch Antetokounmpo.
No. In better Seattle summer sports news, the Seattle Sounders, after a 3-0 loss Wednesday at Sporting Kansas City, finally snapped
not
their,
that much better.
Snapped their three-match losing streak by beating Real Salt Lake 1-0 on Saturday. I said last week they needed at least 2 points, I think, from these two games, and they got three. So, hey, we're not panicking.
Yeah, things weren't looking great on Wednesday.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, like, I had this game on the second screen as I was watching whatever the playoff game was that night. Because that was Boston-Cleveland game one. And the Sounders, like, completely dominated the first half. They had, I think at one point, maybe that might have been Saturday. It was like an 11-1 shot differential on Saturday at one point. But they completely dominated the first half, couldn't score a goal, and then Sporting kind of scored against the run of play, and then the floodgates opened from there.
It seems like this has happened to them a lot this year.
I mean, in terms of expected goals, that game was basically even. And then the Sounders on Saturday probably could have beat Real Salt Lake worse than they did. Did, among other things, had a Clint Dempsey penalty kick saved by Nick Raimondo that would have put them up 2-0. In that game, had a ton of chances in the first half, didn't really convert them until a Harry Shipp goal was shot was deflected into the net. Was how they finally
hey, that's what it takes.
Nick Raimondo. Hey, you know, sometimes that's what it takes. But the underlying stats are back to being pretty good. The Sounders are now number 2 in MLS in expected goal differential on American Soccer Analysis. Yeah. They are the unluckiest team in the MLS when you compare their expected goal differential to their actual goal differential. So things are looking up a little bit. We'll see. Also, maybe a little healthier, despite the fact that Will Bruin dislocated his elbow late in that match against Real Salt Lake. But we saw Brad Evans made his first start of the year at right back.
There we go.
So that was encouraging. Then another piece of news from this week. The Players received their MLS Cup championship rings on Tuesday.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about going forward? What does it look like for the team as a whole? Will they be adding players or...
I would expect that. So Garth Lagerwey was on KJR on Saturday before the match and said that the team would try to add one or two or possibly three players this summer.
Really?
They've got, I guess, five roster spots open and have the ability to buy down Osvaldo Alonso's salary to take him out of the designated player slot and have enough money to add a designated player if they so desire.
Has there been any smoke around anybody?
I haven't seen any lately, no. I mean, and this is not going to happen until July. So we've got some time until this kind of addition will happen.
Yes, and then there'll be another 6 months after that. Of
yes, there will. But, you know, I think that we will see some fortification of the roster for sure.
What position do you feel like they need fortification the most at?
That's a good question. I don't have a strong feeling about it, partially because we haven't seen like the intact back line to know.
But you wouldn't have a designated player on the back line almost certainly, right?
Probably not, no. And I guess maybe, you know, some kind of wide midfielder would be the spot. I mean, you know, that's where they've been using Ship sort of in that role, and then Alvaro Fernandez when he plays.
And some Jovan Jones coming forward.
Well, he's going to slot at left back, but you would like someone else is like a traditional midfield style winger, I guess, would probably be the one thing I would say. I don't know. Other people might have better answers to that than I do, since I'm far from a soccer X's and O's expert.
But the team is still, for the types of players that you have as designated players, they're still pretty well stacked.
Right. I mean, in terms of attacking players, the fact that Jordan Morris isn't a DP, you know, you've got a very talented player in that spot. And then, you know, Dempsey and Lodero both kind of playing in the middle of the pitch.
So what about coming up for the Sounders?
It's Derby week. The hated Portland Timbers coming to town for the first time in the 2017 season. They'll also be coming here for the U.S. Open Cup after the Sounders won that coin flip to host that match down the road. But the Timbers coming off a 4-1 loss at Montreal on Saturday, and worse yet, in that match, defensive midfielder Diego Chara red-carded and will miss this game now with suspension. So that'll hurt because already the Timbers' defense was not very good. The 538 Soccer Power Index had their defense is the fifth worst in the MLS. But they do have a pretty potent attack at this point. It's immediately the last two MLS Cup winners, even though neither of those teams are quite playing at that level right now. Diego Valeri is tied for ninth in the MLS with 9 goals and assists. And then Fernando Adi, who has been a bit of a thorn in the Sounders' side in the past, has 6 goals so far this season, as does Valeri.
But this feels like something where the Sounders offensively might be able to get off a little bit.
I think so, yeah.
Because they have not had a good offensive game in a long time. Or no. They've played well but haven't gotten the ball into the net.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it would be a good game to score a couple goals.
Still waiting on the moment that they can break through. It feels like since the beginning of the season we've been waiting on that moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we thought we had it for a period there, like the game in LA where they won, 3-0 in that one?
Yeah, that was a big one.
That was the moment where it really felt like, okay, everything's coming together. And then immediately they followed that by taking 1 point from their next 4 matches. So, you know, we'll see.
It's a very long season.
But the underlying stats remain good. Quick update on the Seattle Storm. They beat the Washington Mystics 81-71 on Sunday. Sue Bird returned to the lineup for the first time this season and, inspired by her appearance on the fabulous Pelton cast, had 9 points and 10 assists in her return to the lineup. But the big story so far, Jewel Lloyd is just killing it.
Really?
She's having a terrific season. It's been kind of a slow start, I would say, for Brianna Stewart, who was shooting 1 of 10 well into the late stages of this game before she got a couple of late baskets. She's still coming off the knee injury she had in China and hasn't quite been right so far. But Jewel led with 26 points in 29 minutes on 10 of 14 shooting in this one. And just really, she's making threes. She is so far 8 of 13 from three-point range, which will probably regress to the mean. Small sample size. But I, you know, watching her in practice and during the preseason, her stroke is much improved from there, and she was a 30% three-point shooter last year. So if, you know, if she's even at 35, she becomes a much more difficult player to guard with her athleticism. She's made 10 field goals in all three games so far and is averaging 26 points per game.
Wow.
So she good. This weekend, the Storm, continuing their extended homestand here, will host New York and Indiana. Indiana coming to town for the second time in 2 weeks because the WNBA schedule is very weird.
And
because
there's 6 teams.
There's 12. It's more than that. But the schedule is just weird. So like they don't have conferences anymore.
Okay.
They play teams either 3 or 4 times. So like many East teams will travel here twice. Why you would do that within 2 weeks, I don't quite understand.
This feels like a classic Sonics road trip, though. Friday and Sunday with New York and Indiana.
Yes, yes, very much so. Anything else on sports?
No.
Well, I wanted to close today with a letter that we received. People taking advantage of their chance to reach out to us at peltoncast@gmail.com. Also, I wanted to thank everyone who left more reviews and ratings on iTunes last week. Really appreciated that. Some very amusing reviews, I would have to say.
They're great.
But I thought this letter deserved to be read. And you have not seen this because it came
a little bit scared.
It came to the Peltoncast Gmail address, and I am the only one who checks that.
I have no access to any Peltoncast social media.
This is from loyal listener Jack. Says, KP and Tristan, on the pod a couple months ago, you changed my life.
Okay.
When you explained the Pock Pock sneak strategy to the listener. As a proud Seattleite who enjoys occasional forays south to visit our strange, slightly unkempt, yet ultimately lovable little brother, Portland, I frequently ran into the issue of trying to get a stop to Pock Pock while there or driving through. As you know, weekend lunchtime there is murder, and I don't have the same affinity for waiting outside a restaurant for a table for hours on end as so many Portlanders
it's
seem
not
to.
From Portland.
Last month, I had the perfect opportunity to try out the Pock Pock sneak when my girlfriend surprised me with a weekend trip to the Willamette Valley for my birthday. We decided to stop on our way back to Seattle on Sunday. We had to be back in Seattle by a certain time, so I explained to her that we could make it if we successfully executed the Pock Pock sneak.
Oh my god!
I was driving, so she put in the order when we were about 20 minutes out. We get there, park, and lo and behold, our order is just finishing being prepared.
Oh, my God.
This is interesting. It was an alternate sneak.
Ooh.
We take it next door to the Imperial Tap Room.
Okay.
A location I have never been. And ordered a beer from their fine selection, a crisp, light, refreshing Pilsner for me since I still had a long drive ahead of me, a heftier, piney IPA for the wife.
Oh, man.
We open the food to dig in, and instantly the aroma of fish sauce and dried shrimp fills the place.
This is like my favorite moment right now.
No time to be concerned for the other patrons, however. The feast before us is simply too enticing. The brief travel time in two-go containers didn't seem to have any effect on the food either. As usual, it was fantastic.
Oh, man. The Pock Pock sneak is really one of the greatest things you've ever done. I'm so impressed
we're going to talk about my other one next week, by the way.
Oh, your other good sneak. Yep. I actually heard one of my coworkers talk about your other sneak today. Explain it to somebody who was coming.
The
in
word's
town.
Getting out there.
Yeah, I think you may not have invented that
one.
Yeah,
no, I don't.
But
think
But the
so.
Pock Pock sneak is—it really is the greatest thing that you've done in your entire life. I love because you had a story where you were hanging out. Did we tell this on the podcast? You were hanging out with Alan Horton, the Minnesota Timberwolves announcer.
We might have told this on the podcast.
And then you explained to him the Pock Pock sneak?
Well, I mean, I took him on the Pock Pock sneak.
I just love the idea of telling other people about it. And just like the description of this is, you would have to wait in line for a very long time otherwise, but I have this brilliant plan.
Exactly. And then he asked about, when we went back, we actually went and sat down because it was like a Wednesday night at like 9 o'clock and there was no line. But he asked if we were doing the sneak when we went
back. On Horton.
He did. No. So the Imperial the Imperial Bottle Shop and Tap Room, which is indeed right next door, and an inclusive list of taps here.
Really?
Yeah. So
wow. So that makes it even easier.
I don't know if they have the outdoor patio. That's the key feature of the.
It depends on when you're in Portland.
Exactly. That may be better much of the year.
I knew we were saving lives with what we were doing.
All right, let me finish this out here.
Okay.
All right, all of this is a long-winded way of saying thank you for introducing me to the Pock Pock Sneak. I think my girlfriend would thank you too. Sincerely, loyal listener Jack, Queen Anne, Seattle. P.S. Tristan's rating for You Need a Burger, my pick for best burger in Seattle, is borderline criminal.
I loved every single bit of that.
This, we peaked. Like, we can't top this.
Oh my God.
As we're gonna know. So, thank you very much for listening, Jack. And thank you so much for writing. Appreciated it. On that note, again, this can't be topped. We got to go out now.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.